May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Andrew Hale. I represent the defendants, appellants, Softbellies, Inc., and Positive Products Consultants, LLC. The underlying case here was a trademark dispute. There was no claim for copyright infringement. The case was tried to a jury. After 2 days of deliberations, the jury was deadlocked 9-3. The parties agreed to accept a 9-3 verdict, which was rendered in favor of Tide. Under trademark law, the likelihood of confusion standard requires that a plaintiff demonstrate a likelihood, not the mere possibility, of confusion. Here, the district court, based on the evidence at trial, should have granted Softbellies motion for judgment as a matter of law at the close of plaintiff's case. I'd like to just briefly talk about some of the likelihood of confusion factors, and if I could, I'd like to do a little show and tell for the court and show them some of the products at issue. Tide, as we all know, makes Beanie Babies, and Tide's products are all marketed with the red Tide heart, which is Tide admits is a well-known logo to consumers. All their brands, their stuffed animals have the red Tide heart. Their attic treasures have the red Tide heart. Their Zodiac products have the red Tide heart, and their Beanie Babies have the red Tide heart. These products are known by the red Tide heart, not the word beanie. These are called Beanie Babies, true enough, but consumers who want to purchase a Tide Beanie Baby look for the red Tide heart. Softbellies came up with a product. They called it Screeny Beanies. Here's an example of one. They had been in the business of making monitor cleaners, so they decided, in fact, Michael Bivens, their sales rep, decided, hey, let's combine the theme of Beanie Babies with monitor cleaners. They put the chamois belly on there, and there's a hang tag and it says Screeny Beanies. The tag looks nothing like Tide's tag. Different colors, different shape. It's not marketed like Tide markets its product at all. And the most telling thing is, these products are not sold at any of the same stores. Tide's 1999 customer list had 20 to 25,000 authorized retailers. They couldn't identify a single one of those that sold Screeny Beanies. Even their updated customer list at the time of trial, which had over 17,000 retailers, they identified two that maybe sold Beanie Babies. They weren't sold in the same stores. They're sold at different price points. This product, Softbellies, is twice as much. It's $10 retail. This is $5. So not only different stores and different price points, and the packaging was incredibly different. Softbellies sometimes sold their products on backer cards with cable ties, and they'd hang in a store like this. They also sold them in plastic bags with bag toppers, in a plastic bag with a bag topper. And they also sold them in displays, and these exhibits are in the record, that showed, highlighted the fact that they're computer monitor cleaners. You know, the displays have computer monitors in the boxes, and the displays show that the product, highlight the fact that the product is used to clean computer monitors. The other factor is there's no evidence of actual confusion. Tide had a whole host of experts at trial on genericness, didn't have a likelihood of confusion expert, and they admitted in request to admit, and it's Exhibit 53, on and on and on. Tide's not aware of a single instance in which a person has been confused, mistaken, or deceived as to the source of defendant's good or services. Tide's not aware of a single instance in which a person has purchased a Screeny Beanies, believing the product to be affiliated or associated with Tide.
Now, Mr. Bivens did testify he was asked all the time about Tide in connection with Screeny Beanies products, right? And there were at least two potential customers who asked for and got indemnification from Bivens in the event they were sued by Tide. Because the issue is not, you know, whether you had a slam dunk. The issue is whether there's a reasonable whether a reasonable jury could have found that there was some confusion or likelihood of confusion. So there was some evidence to the contrary.
Well,
plus the visual.
Mr. Bivens did testify to that, but there were two issues with that. First of all, he claimed there was an indemnity agreement, didn't have the agreements, couldn't tell us who asked for the agreements, couldn't tell us who he talked to. He had absolutely no evidence to back up his claim orally in court that these customers asked for some kind of indemnification. He came into court with no facts about anything, and he came into court as a very biased witness, having been in litigation against Softbellies for years. So he did testify to that, but he had didn't produce the indemnity agreements, didn't produce any documentation to support his claim. And that, at best, I still think, at best, that is de minimis evidence of actual confusion that even if he proved it, wouldn't be sufficient to support likelihood of confusion in this case, because that's all Ty had.
Well, but so your position would be, even though the products, when you look especially the Beanie Baby and the Screenie Baby, even though they're similar in size, they're both filled with beans, they both have beanies in the titles, they both have hang tags, I appreciate that you've shown us a distinction, they both have a poem, that's not enough.
No, with all due respect, I don't think it's enough, and I don't think any reasonable jury would think it's enough. That's why Ty didn't have a likelihood of confusion survey. They couldn't do it. People wouldn't be confused by these two products. My 5-year-old daughter would know the difference between these two products. They produced a video at trial. Ty showed a DVD of people, you know, piling into stores. Little girls saying, oh, my peanut Beanie Baby's now worth $500. My Garcia Beanie Baby went up in value. These things, if you remember, it was a frenzy. They were highly collected. Everybody knew them. They knew where to get them at little mom-and-pop stores. And they knew the red tag. And Ty even produced evidence.
How long ago was that, counsel? About 20 years?
No, the peak was 98-99. That was the peak. They're still being sold today. There's not the frenzy that there was then. They're still being sold in mom-and-pop, you know, retail stores. They're not sold at mass merchants. They're marketed completely different. And the tags, you know, Ty likes to claim, you know, that the idea of a poem and a name is something original to it. That's been around for a long time, too. Cabbage Patch Dolls and things, we can go way back. There's nothing novel about the fact that there's a name and a poem on there.
I'm unclear about the judgment. Is there a damages judgment? Did the jury award damages?
Well, there couldn't be a judgment because that was forfeited as part of the sanction Judge Lefkoe imposed based on Ty Warner's conduct.
But the jury did award $700,000? And
no.
That was taken away, or what?
Right. At the first trial in front
of
Judge...
the first trial. This is current judgment. Judgment that you're appealing. What's that judgment?
Injunctive relief, barring Soft Bellies.
What did the jury do?
They found that Soft Bellies...
And did the jury award damages?
No.
I don't understand. What did the jury do? It just gave an answer to a question?
Right. It gave an answer to the questions about whether there was infringement, and based on that, a permanent injunction was entered.
Okay, so now what's your understanding of what the injunction requires you to do?
To not use the name Beanie, Screeny Beanies, or any confusingly similar name
to it. Can you use Screeny?
I would think we could use Screeny. It's a judgment call, but I personally think that's not confusing.
But you'd have to remove Beanies.
We'd have to remove Beanies.
Is that it?
In terms of the...
Is that what we have to do for compliance?
I think that's about it.
Well, is that a hardship?
Well, in and of itself, it's not a hardship, but the goodwill that was built up with the product, all the product that had been labeled and tagged, and the time that had gone into marketing the product, you know, with catchy names, Screeny Beanies, as Mr. Devaney testified. It's like Yo-Yo or Hula Hoop or...
But there are other companies, at least there's at least one other company that makes the same product, isn't there?
Besides Ty?
No, besides your company.
That makes a beanbag product?
For cleaning computer screens.
Oh, I'm not aware of that.
Well, I've seen one that didn't have Screeny Beanie on it.
You may have seen, after the injunction, it just had a tag that said Soft Bellies.
Right.
That's how they changed the tags to comply with the injunction. They just put
Why isn't Soft Bellies a perfectly good trademark for you?
Well,
guys?
You know, Soft Bellies, you know, could be used as a name, but it's not as catchy of a name. It's not as snappy of a name from a marketing standpoint. And, you know, Ty likes to say, well, just name it something else. Well, that's fine for Ty to argue. We'd like to name it Screeny Beanies because we like the name and think it's a good way to market the product. Of course we could call it, you know, 100 other things, but the question is, do we have to? And we want to use the Screeny Beanies name. The other issue I'd like to address briefly is the trial really turned into just a circus of Ty bringing in all their other beanie products up to the present. I mean, that's all the trial was Scott Rogers and Linda Colson and Ty Warner talking about now they've got Alphabet Beanies and Zodiac Beanies and E Beanies and MC Beanies and parading in all the different beanies and showing them to the jury. And all these came up the last 6-7 years. The jury, I think, was improperly influenced to think that either Sopley's was infringing those marks or that somehow Thai had bigger rights to the word beanie than it really had. And I think it was prejudicial for Thai to spend the bulk of its trial, and if you read the trial transcript, that's pretty much all their witnesses did was talk about all these other beanie products. It was very prejudicial to Sopbelly's. The third issue I want to touch on briefly.
Yeah, I'd like you to get to the sanction issue because originally the district court's basis for imposing the sanction was that Warner had lied and his actions amounted to witness tampering. But the court vacated those two findings but still imposed the same sanction. Wasn't that harsh or was that really in proportion to the conduct here?
No, I don't think it was harsh. The court still found there to be serious misconduct by Mr. Warner in his conversation with Harold Nizamian to dissuade him from testifying. The fact that Nizamian wasn't called as a witness at trial, I had him there ready to testify. I was going to call him, but frankly, I personally thought the likelihood of confusion evidence was so overwhelming after putting on Mr. Bivens and Mr. Devaney. I was ready for that case to go to the jury because I was convinced I was going to win, and I would have never taken a 9-3 verdict if I didn't think otherwise.
Well, but didn't the district court find that Nizamian understood that Warner was upset and asked him as a friend not to get involved and told him that his hands were full, he wouldn't get involved, and the district court found that Nizamian was not intimidated in any way by the phone call?
No, he wasn't intimidated, but what he said
was... And he was actually in court, wasn't he, at some point?
He was in court. Yes, he was, because he was in Chicago to testify at trial. But since we didn't call him, he did come over and watch the closing arguments. He lives out in the San Francisco area. No, he did testify he wasn't intimidated, but what he said was, based on the seriousness in this tone of voice and how important he said it was to him, then I decided, you know what, I guess I just won't do this. So I don't think Thai can argue that, oh, because Nizami wasn't called to trial and he wasn't that big of a witness. That doesn't excuse what they did, and I don't think the sanction, frankly, I thought Judge Lefkoe should have dismissed the case. And I think that's the appropriate sanction that should have been entered, especially with somebody like Thai Warner, who's a frequent litigator in this court.
But that recent Supreme Court case talks about actual lying. I mean, and I think that's what, I think it's the Arthur Anderson case. And
right.
So when the court looked at that, the reason the court didn't dismiss it was because he hadn't lied during the testimony and the evidence didn't support the previous finding that he had tampered with the witness. So when you look at that case, I mean, I think Judge Lefkoe appropriately didn't dismiss it. She looked at some other sanction, because this also brings to mind, what if you had the head of a company who was talking to a close friend before the trial and the friend was also a potentially adverse witness and the company head confided his worry about the potential effect on his business? Is it your position that that contact would automatically be sanctionable too? In other words,
well,
where are the limits?
I'd have to hear the context of the conversation. At the evidentiary hearing in this case, this was not a friendly, like, hey, let's just have a little chat. How's it going? Oh, by the way, I got this trial. This was, as soon as I told him at his deposition that Nizamian was testifying as an expert, he went back to his office, called up Nizamian on the phone, because we had the phone records, and in a harsh tone, in a serious tone, told him this is important to him. It was going to hurt him if he testified.
Here's the problem I have with your with the sanctions. So, as I understand it, the actual cost to you was $78,000?
In attorney's fees, correct.
Then the sanction is about 10 times that. Now, what's the justification for a tenfold increase? I don't understand.
Well, I think the fact, when you have the head of a company, the head of Thai, here calling up a known witness for the other side and basically trying to convince them not to testify, that is affects so much the integrity of the judicial system. It's so important to the administration of justice that I think a harsh sanction is appropriate.
It could be, of course, but it didn't have any real consequence here. And of course, Warner has taken a big hit.
But
this is a big embarrassment for. Look at how your opponents spend much more time on a sanctions issue than they do defending their trademark, right?
Well,
so obviously it's important to this film.
To answer your question, though, if it was $78,000, to Ty Warner, Whoop-de-doo.
Yeah, like, that would, you could say that for $100 million, right? So that can't be right. That can't be right.
I don't think the court abuses discretion in having Ty forfeit the damages award.
And you don't have any cases that support a tenfold sanction amount, do you?
No, we don't.
Because this was actual expenses that you incurred. And, you know, so we need some rationale for a tenfold increase, you know.
I acknowledge that it was an arbitrary number that Judge Lefkoe picked, and we don't have case law on the ratio. I see I'm out of time. I'd like to say, I don't know if I have any time for rebuttal, but...
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hale. Mr. White?
May it please the Court, my name is James White. I represent Ty, Inc., and with me is my co-counsel, Ms. Louise Walsh. Just to go back to Mr. Hale's opening argument on his appeal, what I think Mr. Hale is asking this Court to do is to reweigh the evidence. It was a Rule 59 motion that he filed with a court subsequent to trial, subsequent to the verdict. And as we know, it's the reasonable basis for the jury to, if it exists, to enter the verdict that they did, leaving credibility of the witnesses and the weight of the evidence to the jury to decide. And on each and every of the seven DuPont factors, with respect to likelihood of confusion, there was evidence submitted, and it's set forth in the record, and it's argued in our brief. Putting that aside, with respect to the second point that he made with regard to putting into evidence all of the Beanie products subsequent to their entry into the marketplace in November of 1998, that evidence is relevant for two reasons. Number one, it goes to the strength of the Beanie's mark that Ty has established over the years. And it also goes to genericness, which, as this Court will recall...
What was your first point? I missed that.
It goes to the strength of the mark. It goes to the likelihood of confusion issue. And you put in that evidence to show that the Beanie's mark is a very, very strong mark, which is a factor in consideration of the likelihood of confusion. With respect to the second point that it's relevant to whether or not Beanie's is generic. As this Court well knows, when we were here the last time, that was the heart of their defense.
No, it bothers me about that. What are they supposed to... What are your competitors supposed to call these bean bag creatures?
We tried to settle this case years ago. In fact, I thought this case should have settled long, long time ago. I never thought it would go to this length. All we asked them to do was take... Pardon me?
Neither did we.
I can appreciate that, Your Honor. All we asked them to do was knock off the IE, make it screeny beans, and this case was over.
But you see, I mean, you go back to something like Sanka. So when Sanka was the overwhelmingly popular decaffeinated coffee, Maxwell House was in terrible fear that it would become the generic term. And they, you know, did everything they could to sponsor an alternative, to encourage restaurants and so on to use the term decaffeinated coffee. Well, that was a loser, but finally decaf appeared. That became the generic. So Sanka was saved, although I suppose it's probably disappeared. So what has Ty done to sponsor some generic equivalent? What is it you want your competitors to call these things? You surely don't mean you want them to
anything
call
them
beans.
Anything but beans.
Well, what? You can't use a trademark to make your competitors speechless and incapable of describing what their product is.
They're not incapable of describing what their product is.
Well, give me an example of what's a good generic term for this category of products.
Screeny beanbag toys. Screeny beans. Screeny beanbag toys. Screeny beanbag computer cleaners.
They're not toys, though.
Oh, they're computer cleaners, Judge.
Right. So if they said beanbag screen cleaners or something. That would be okay.
That'd be fine with me.
Okay. I had one other question. So look, this injunction. Is this injunction going to Judge Kaney's question? Is this injunction going to be the beginning of a whole new litigation parade about compliance?
Well, it depends on what happens.
What but is your since, conception since of what is enjoined?
The use of beanies.
Well, but what about, but it also says confusingly similar.
Right. So if you use something that is confusingly similar.
What would be an example?
Offhand, I can't think of anything except the word beanie right now. But to take an analogy, for example, many times during the heyday of this enforcement program, people would use a red heart, and instead of having tie, they would say my. That presents a problem.
So what about like the tag and the placement of the name tag and the poem? In terms of your ideal world under the injunction, would the tag have to be placed somewhere else?
No.
Would the poem be acceptable?
Poem is acceptable.
The name is acceptable.
No, the name is not acceptable.
I mean, the name of whatever the, their specific names. That's okay.
Cyberspace.
I'm just trying to figure out.
It's just the use of the word beanie, Your Honor. For example, they have one. We have Cubby Bear. They have Cyberspace. They use a poem. We're not looking to enjoin the use of a poem. You can draft your own poem. They don't use the same poem that we use for our bear that they use.
I'm just trying to narrow in on where the dispute really lies and what it really is that you want to see change.
Right. The heart of this controversy, Judge, was beanies, i.e., in the word beanies.
If you say Cubby Bear, you have that Cubby Bear. Did you say Cubby Bear?
Yes.
But that doesn't use beanie in it necessarily.
No. Right? No, what happened, Your Honor, is during the course of this phenomenal run on this toy back in the 90s, is the public came to refer to Ty's toys as beanies. It had Beanie Babies on it and Beanie Babies collection on the inside of the hang tag. And those are two registered incontestable marks. And the surveys that we put into evidence indicated that, in fact, the public had come to refer to Ty's toys in a shortened nickname as beanies. And that's how the mark came. We applied for registration. We have not received registration yet.
So would the title Screen Beans be okay?
Screen Beans is fine.
I ask you about the sanction issue. I understand, of course, the issue we discussed with Mr. Hale of just disproportionality, but I'm curious about this argument that you have to have clear and convincing evidence. What bothers me about it is, in an ordinary tort case, when punitive damages are awarded, there has to be a finding of some kind of deliberate or willful conduct, but the standard of proof is not raised. So why would it be here?
Well, I guess our theory, Your Honor, is when you have a serious punitive damages, as the court has noted, a tenfold penalty, which is punitive. I mean, there's no doubt about it. There's no way for Mr. Warner to purge himself of that. It's certainly not remedial. It may act as a deterrent. I can assure you it has.
Let's hope so.
I can assure you of that. So you end up with a situation where there should be some heightened burden of proof. Even Judge Lefkoe said in a footnote in the first opinion, she says, I can't find this beyond the preponderance because I'm just finding, as we know, instead of saying he's a liar and a perjurer, it's just that he lacks credibility vis-a-vis Mr. Nazamian. But we think, since you're taking a severe punitive damage, a tenfold increase in really what the damage was to the other side and the cost of them bringing it to the court's attention, this improper conduct, this improper telephone call, as we now know from Judge Lefkoe's hearing, that there ought to be a heightened burden of proof. Are we talking
about throwing it all out or reducing the amount?
Well, my first position, Judge, and it's set forth in our brief in great detail, is that the penalty should, the damages should be reinstated, and the, because this should be remedial based upon the facts that we know today. When we were here last.
So then you're saying that the conduct was sanctionable and you're not quarreling with that. I thought you were quarreling with that too.
And
as it relates to the burden of proof as well. But I thought you were saying he shouldn't have been sanctioned at all. No, you're just saying this, the penalty was too great.
No, first of all, Judge Williams, what I'm saying is the conduct we now agree in hindsight, I agree. We accept Judge Lefkoe's findings.
Okay.
Okay? The conduct was improper. Mm-hmm. Now, the question becomes whether or not it should be a civil sanction or a quasi-criminal sanction. And the as when Judge Lefkoe went through this in three different opinions, she says, well, until the Court of Appeals tells me that I should have clear and convincing, I'm going to do it on a preponderance basis. But I can't find this on any other heightened standard. Then she withdraws the witness tampering, the bad faith, if you will, the perjury and the liar claims that she earlier found. So you are left now with a situation where you have improper conduct. Is it quasi-criminal? If it's quasi-criminal, we should have a heightened standard of proof, a burden of proof where it's clear and convincing evidence. If it's really a civil situation where you need to admonish and deter the actor from doing that type of act again, then it should be a civil penalty, i.e., the $78,000 in fees that Mr. Hale and his counsel spent in bringing it to the court's attention so that the court could admonish Mr. Warner. But what we really have is the facts and the circumstances changed. Warner is not a witness tamper. He's not a liar. He's not a perjurer. And Mr. Nazamian wasn't the star witness. He had no impact on Softbelly's ability to fairly present their case at trial. We thought when we were here before that Mr. Nazamian was going to testify that Beanie's was generic and was generic as of 1988 or before, long before Mr. Warner ever entered the market. That's what this court had said before. That's what we thought based upon the arguments that were made. Now, if that's the case, and Beanie's was their number one, the genericness of Beanie's was the number one defense to knock this out so they could use the word Beanie's, why in God's name didn't you call that person as a witness? He was in Chicago. He was in the courtroom when I made the closing argument to the jury. Why didn't you put him on the stand the day before? There was absolutely no evidence that Beanie's was generic. It was an easy judgment for Judge Lefkoe at the close of their case to enter my Rule 50 motion that Beanie's was not generic for plush toys. The reason was is that there was no evidence at all. And the star witness that he talked about to this court and in the previous briefs was in Chicago, ready to go, and didn't appear. I have my own views on that. My view on that is that he didn't have any personal knowledge that Beanie's was generic. In fact, everything, when we deposed him before the hearing on the witness tampering issue, he testifies, well, he doesn't have any personal knowledge. Everything that was in that declaration, all of the exhibits, were provided to him by counsel. So that's my view of the situation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. White.
Thank you.
Mr. Hale, your time has expired, but we'll give you a minute, if you'd like.
Thank you, Judge. Just briefly, on the Harold Azami and star witness point, clearly Ty Warner thought he was a star witness because Ty Warner scurried right back to his office and called Azamian. Ty Warner worked with Azamian for 20 years. He knew about Azamian's personal experience in the toy industry. He knew he could be a significant witness.
Let me just ask you one question on this. I have to ask you about this this sanction. Really, if you put the injunctive relief aside, the tantamount effect of what Judge Lefkoe did was dismiss. It was the functional equivalent of a dismissal, right? You really can't distinguish it much from her granting a dismissal of the suit other than injunctive relief.
Well,
looking at it a different way, other than the 10 times thing.
Well, if you say putting the injunction aside, but that was the whole case. If she dismissed the case, we can sell Screeny Beanies, which we should be able to do. If she dismisses the case, we're selling Screeny Beanies and life is good. The second thing on the clear and convincing standard, we did find a case that came out shortly before I think our reply brief was submitted from this court, Wade versus Soo Line Railroad, 500 Fed 3rd, 559. And the quote in there was, Maynard held that dismissal is an appropriate sanction for a violation of Rule 37 only when there is clear and convincing evidence of willfulness, bad faith, or fault. We doubt that clear and convincing evidence is required. The Supreme Court held in Grogan versus Garner that heightened standards of proof do not apply in civil cases unless a statute says so or the Constitution requires an elevated burden. See also Herman versus Ann McLean versus Huddleston. So I think this court has spoken again just last year on the issue, and the clear and convincing evidence standard should not be applied. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hale. Thank you to both counsel.